In October, Republicans enacted a new congressional map that reconfigured the boundaries of U.S. Representative Jeff Jackson's district. They cracked the district near Charlotte, which Jackson won by more than 15 points in 2022, and divided voters into two districts that heavily favor GOP voters. It was an effort made possible by the new Republican majority on the North Carolina Supreme Court, which reversed a key ruling limiting extreme partisan gerrymandering it issued just months ago. That from The Guardian in 2024. And now this. Former President Donald Trump would love to take down Adam Kinzinger, one of his chief House GOP antagonists in next year's midterms, but Democrats might beat him to it. Illinois lawmakers are on the verge of rolling out a new congressional map that will very likely gut Kinzinger's exurban Chicago seat, according to several sources close to the redistricting process, leaving him with just a few bleak options for remaining in office next year. That from the publication Politico in 2021. From that, we see that both Democrats and Republicans have used gerrymandering to get or keep political power in their states. How does gerrymandering work, and how does it affect your vote? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Tim Cullen, former Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader and Secretary of Health and Human Services under Governor Tommy Thompson. He's also the author of Wisconsin Gerrymandering, published in 2024 by Little Creek Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
It is that strange term for a strange political phenomenon that has been with us for a long time. And before we get into the nuts and bolts of the way it works in Wisconsin in particular, let's look at the history of how this whole process started. How long has gerrymandering been with us?
Well, it's been with us for sure since 1812, and highly likely that's when most of the historic records show, and it was occurring in Massachusetts. And the governor's name was Elbridge Gerry. And there was one district that was just had more angles and turns and arms and legs and everything else, and a reporter called it a salamander. And then when Governor Gerry signed that map into law, the reporter said, well, I think we've stopped calling it a salamander. We're going to start calling it a gerrymander. So initially it started with a hard G. Over time now across the nation, everybody calls it a gerrymander. But it started at least then, but it had to be going on before 1812.
Where does redistricting come from, that whole concept?
It comes from the U.S. Census requirement. We have a U.S. Census every year since 1790, and every 10 years it ends in zero. And the purpose of it is to determine the population change versus 10 years before that, the previous census. And then that census is then used to find out the legislative districts, whether one district's grown a lot more in population, another one has shrunk in population, for example, and then redraw the district lines to make them equal in population. That's really what it's all about, at least in the modern era. And but the main point that I like to make is that you can comply with every census requirement, every court ruling, every legislative decision, and still gerrymander. And that's what always, in fact, you'll hear elected officials say, this map is not a gerrymander. It complies with all federal requirements. And the actual answer is you can do both.
So if we visualize this and we're looking at, let's say, even as reflected in the examples that we started with, if we start with a district that's, let's say, heavily Republican and a district next to it or a couple of districts that might have Democratic leanings, how would one part or the other gain from redistricting in a situation like that?
Well, each party would do something in that area, but they do very different things. If they had a Republican legislator who already had a fairly safe district, they might not do anything. But if that district was like really competitive, and the Republican, it was sort of like a 52-48 assembly seat. Then they would look at those districts you talked about who were next to it, and zigzag the lines to bring some Republicans in from those two Democratic districts to make this 52-48 district for that Republican a 60-40 district. That's what Republicans would do. And the Democrats, would sort of be reverse situation. They do the same thing. They would make their own member safer by bringing in Democrats from the districts next to it.
Who has the authority to redraw these lines? Is it the same in all the states, or does it vary?
It varies. About 36 states do it the way we do, which is the legislature draws the maps, and then the governor vetoes them, and then if it can get in the courts if they can't reach an agreement or whatever. But 13 states have a commission where it's appointed by the legislature and governor. The commission is made up equally of like six Democrats and six Republicans. It's completely bipartisan, and that commission draws the maps. And that can work. In fact, that's one of the solutions that I recommend in the book. It's not my first one, but it's my second one. And that commission draws them, and everybody's really pretty happy in those states. And then the one state is Iowa that does it differently.
When you say the legislature, though, right away, if it's a Republican legislature or a Democratic legislature, they have the power to maintain their control by redistricting.
Exactly. And if they have also, if that party also has the governorship as well, they will do that. I point out early in the book that actually gerrymandering is not a partisan issue. It's an abuse of power issue. And if one party has total control, governorship, both houses, in the year after the census, so the year ends in number one, they can't help themselves. They will gerrymander. They did it in Wisconsin. The Republicans did. The Democrats did it in Illinois. Democrats have done it in Massachusetts and Rhode Island and New York. Republicans have done it in Michigan and North Carolina. So it's abuse of power. That's what it really is.
There's no, from what you've said already, Tim, there's no constitutional addressing of the gerrymander because it seems to predate the earliest years of the Republic. But do these things ever get taken to Supreme Courts, state Supreme Courts, U.S. Supreme Courts, one way or the other?
Yes. The U.S. Supreme Court said you could not take state legislative redistricting issues to them until they're federal issues.
Right.
But that changed in the 1960s. And so some cases have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court. Some cases in our court did not get involved during the whole first half of the, more than first half of the 20th century. But the Supreme Court in Wisconsin got involved in the early 1960s following the 1960 census. And nobody could get agreement. And so they actually ran the 1962 elections on the maps that were in effect for the 1950s. They had to use the old maps. But then following that, the Supreme Court got serious. And they reached an agreement, and there were fair maps for the 1964 election and going forward from there.
Well, let's go backward for a minute, and you have some in your book notable instances of how gerrymandering evolved through the 19th century, a time that we often associate with, you know, robber barons and power grabs.
You're talking about the late 19th.
From the Civil War pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that I found difficult to pinpoint back in those when I was reading about that, right, a great document written by the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau. It's called Gerrymandering 2020 or something like that. No Reapportionment 2020. But those the courts back then did not use the word gerrymander. They would use some other phrases that could amount to that. And therefore, the historians didn't use the word either because the court said they had no document to look at to use the word. But the one thing that stayed in place that was just had to have gerrymander-like effects, and that was that what's called the counties, keeping counties intact issue. And by that it meant that you could not have a legislative district that had, for example, the bottom half of Dane County and the northern half of Rock County. You couldn't have a legislative district in parts of counties. You could have a legislative district in one county totally or in two counties totally, but you could not have. And that seemed to have a gerrymander-like effect on how the maps were drawn, because the court in 1892, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, said that they call the equal, having equal populations a sacred right of the citizens. Those are actually the words the court used, sacred right. And then went on to say that keeping counties intact was the most important thing to consider. So keeping counties intact was more important than a sacred right.
Well, there is, I guess, a long tradition of a county being almost a sovereign unit of a state. I mean, it has its own courthouse and its its own law enforcement and its own public officials too. And so was that the basis for this idea of keeping the counties intact as voting units?
I think you're right. First of all, we didn't have any really big cities then. Most of the state was very, very rural and small town. And the county government clearly, it looks to me from what I read, was really a much more powerful unit of government then than it is today. And so I think that had a lot to do with doing what counties wanted.
So
whether
this,
you're a court or whether you're a politician.
Was this preservation of the counties in representation, was that pretty much a national phenomenon in the late 19th century?
That I don't know. I don't know.
But
it was for sure here.
It was for sure in Wisconsin, which has its own history and set of issues involving redistricting and gerrymandering. Were there notable, really egregious cases of gerrymandering in those early years?
Like I say, it looks like it because nobody called it that, the courts or the historians. But it looks like it just because that county intact was such the highest priority. That looks like a gerrymander to me. In fact, there were, by the 1930s, this thing was so far out of whack that after the 30 census, Milwaukee County, after the 1930 census, had one-fourth of all of the people of Wisconsin live in Milwaukee County, one-fourth. Therefore, they should have got one-fourth of the legislative seats, which would have been 25. There were actually 100 seats then. And rather than getting 25 seats, Milwaukee got 20 seats. And so that gave an extra 5 seats to be distributed out in assembly seats in the rural Wisconsin. So that certainly looked like a gerrymander to me, since the Republicans were in control of the legislature following the 1930 census.
Milwaukee was strongly one party or the other?
It was maybe not quite as strong as today, but it was clearly a Democratic county for sure.
And so somehow the Republicans who were in control of the legislature, and did they have the governor too?
They probably did. I don't recall that. But
they were able.
They had an accommodating governor anyway.
They were able to then what, split up Milwaukee as a county and therefore as a voting block.
Well, no, they just allowed to have ignore the equal population requirements. They just, so that the assembly seats in Milwaukee had way more people than some of the outstate assembly seats. But when a legislator from Milwaukee and a legislator from outstate got the Madison and the Capitol, they were equal, even though one represented a whole lot more people than the other one.
And what does that mean, equality of population? It seems like that would be sort of a hard thing to even, I guess you could determine from census to census where the populations were, but the idea was that the actual districts would have equal amounts of adults or voters in them.
Well, it was everybody. It was 2-year-olds. I mean, it was adults as well. The laws never required perfect equality, and the best they could do was to just make sure that the general population was the same. So, and presume therefore that there's probably the same number of people under 21 then who couldn't vote as it would be in this county versus this county. There wouldn't be any reason to think that there would be one county would have a whole lot more voters than kids. You know, that's why they let it go on like that. And it had partisan consequences.
So even if the maps, the redistricting maps, were able to maintain this equality of population from district to district, it would still be very possible to subdivide those districts in a way that would favor one party or the other.
You could. And related to this, of course, is prison gerrymandering. Maybe you're going to get to that.
That is a very interesting topic, too, in your book. That is something I wasn't aware of, and I dare say most of us were not aware of. But you point out that a representative in a district would be happy to have a prison put in his or her district.
Oh, absolutely. Because the requirement is that when you do the census, the U.S. Census, you count the people where they live. Well, guess where prisoners live? They live in prisons. And yet, of course, they cannot vote. So that's what made him so attractive to the legislator, because it gave them the population they needed to meet the requirements. But a smaller number of people could vote for them than a legislator in the district next to them. I never thought, after the more I read about it and thought about it, I'm not so sure it a lot of terrible harm came to Wisconsin because of that. Because one legislator had 10 or 20 more people able to vote for or against them versus the legislator down, you know, in a different county area. So I'm not sure it was inequality, but I wasn't so sure that it was so terribly damaging to democracy or what happened in Madison. But it was amazing. You see, like the Waupun, I even put the map in the book, how they went out of their way. There's this blob, which was the basic 53rd assembly seat, and then there's this long finger that just goes from that part of the major part of the district all the way down and stops at Waupun for one reason only, to get the Waupun district in that legislator's district, who lived a long ways from Waupun.
Well, and now too, you see, I don't know if you have how many of those long tentacles you have in districts in Wisconsin, but even now, if you look at the map, you have some questions, like why is there a kind of a hole in the middle of like the third district, for example?
The islands.
Yeah. So how do those get justified? Those islands that aren't even connected to the main district.
Well, that was the basis for the current state Supreme Court ruling that the maps that were in place following the 2020 election, or census, I mean, that they looked at the, and they discovered in our Constitution was they outlawed islands in the Constitution.
In the state Constitution.
Yeah. And but that had been a lot, but even though it was there, it had been ignored for a long time. And so that was the basis for finding those maps unconstitutional just in late 2023. And that led to then Republicans in the legislature passing what were known as the Evers maps, which were not, they were certainly far more equal at least than, but what the Republicans were worried about was if they didn't adopt the Evers maps, the current state Supreme Court, which is 4-3 liberal, which is something I can remember an era 50 years ago, that never happened. You know, the Supreme Court is acting more like a legislature now. Are they 4-3 liberal or 4-3 Republican?
Well, yes.
Or 4-3 Democrat?
You hear that all the time, don't you, now? Yeah. As a liberal or a conservative justice.
Unheard of 40, 50 years ago.
As if it has become suddenly politicized. Would that redistricting have happened then if it had been a 4-3 conservative court?
Well, no. First of all, the Republicans would not have passed the Evers maps. They would have welcomed the court drawing the maps.
Because the court would have been favorable to those islands.
Although that court had approved a map. That 4-3 conservative had approved a map with the islands. I mean, they found it of the 33 Senate seats, 20 of them had islands in them. And the best way to describe it, everybody knows what an island is, but the best way to describe it in terms of the legislature, is if you get up in the morning in your home in your district and you have to drive through somebody else's district to get to a part of your district that's not touching you, you've got an island. And what it does is it allows you to get rid of areas that you don't want to have to get to an island of voters who you do want to have passed on past voting. And so that, and the assembly was somewhere near this, about the same percentage. It was like, maybe it wasn't quite as bad, but there was 30 or 40 assembly seats out of 99 had islands as well. There were some islands around Dane County.
Products of Democrats, Republicans, both?
Democrats would have wanted them around Dane County because it could make their districts more Democratic by going and getting that island area. But both parties liked islands, actually.
We're going to look further at this strange American phenomenon of gerrymandering when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest Tim Cullen, former Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader and Secretary of Health and Human Services under Governor Tommy Thompson, and also the author of Wisconsin Gerrymandering, published 2024 by Little Creek Press. You were talking, Tim, about prison gerrymandering and the fact that a prison can actually play to the advantage of a legislator in a given district to have a prison in his or her district in terms of providing a suitable population to meet the ground rules for districting. But in your role as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and that gave you considerable experience with the prison populations, didn't it?
Yes, Corrections was a division of that Health and Social Services, which Corrections is now a whole separate state agency. But then it was, so I had a chance to oversee that for nearly 2 years and learned a lot. But this whole issue of the impact on number of equal voters or not equal voters because of prisoners and so on, because they're counted but they can't vote. I thought the more I thought about it was just not a huge deal. I thought the bigger consequence is that these prisons are located a long ways from the population centers of Wisconsin, by and large. Actually, Tommy Thompson put the first one, new one, he put it down in Racine County, just outside the city of Racine, which is very, reachable. These are adult male prisoners that, for families from Sheboygan to Kenosha and Janesville to Beloit, Madison, prisoners from the population centers can get to that prison to visit with the prisoner and keep a family contact. So when they get out of prison, they got something to go back to and not go back to, breaking the law again.
Interesting question, though, of ballots. On the one hand, there presumably was a legislator in that vicinity who would ask the governor, Thompson in this case, well, put the prison in my district. On the other hand, there would have been maybe a more altruistic reason for Governor Thompson to put it there, as you indicate. Do you have a sense of how that balanced out?
Well, he accomplished both, is what he did. He did the right policy thing by getting him out of distant areas of Wisconsin, away from where the homes of a lot of the prisoners were. And there was a Republican state representative in that district and where the prison was built. And so that legislator liked it. And the state Senate seat was held by the then Democratic Majority Leader, Joe Stroll, who had succeeded me. And Governor Thompson had to work with them, Democrats who were in the majority, and so he needed to work, get along with the majority leader, try to get some things done together. So given the prison and jobs in the Senate Majority Leader's district, that didn't hurt either. It worked for policy reasons and it worked for politics reasons.
You say in your book, the easiest way to avoid a primary opponent is to stick with your base. And usually that includes supporting their extreme views. Do nothing that will get you called a compromiser or a moderate. Generally, these base citizens in each party vote in big numbers in the primary. That's that's a kind of a sad commentary on the American system, isn't it, which is based so much on compromise?
Well, it and if the elections that matter, if you don't have a gerrymander, then the elections that matter are the general elections. And so they're, when you don't have a gerrymander, legislators have to be more concerned about moderate voters or independents. You know, they don't have to just play to their base. You can't get elected in a general election in a competitive district. So they, these are all the side effects of gerrymandering, really. I mean, and the legislative leader can recruit an opponent for one of his own member or her own members, and knowing that because it was gerrymandered so badly, anybody who's going to be on the Republican or Democratic ticket, whichever one's wherever the gerrymander occurs, practically anybody, I mean, not anybody, but the candidate of the party that has the majority and has the gerrymander benefiting them, they're going to win the general. They're going to win the general election. But but if you don't stick with your leadership, you can get they call it primaried. Your own leader finds an opponent for you, knowing that that opponent can win in November too. So you're not risking the seat. That's what that I guess I was trying to say anyway.
Are we seeing that in Wisconsin? We kind of see it, I think, in, well, this concept of sticking to your base. We do have candidates on the national level, presidential election, who very much play to their base. But do we see that kind of strategy playing out on a state level in Wisconsin?
That this stuff going on here, mm-hmm. Sure, when we had a gerrymander. We'll see if it changes. It'll change now without a gerrymander. Because now you're going to have all these competitive districts, and if you got a good incumbent who's a reasonably popular and so on, your leader would be a fool to try to knock that person out with some no-name new person, because he or she isn't playing ball with leadership all the time. So, there's all these consequences, and I even talked about how it affects what policy therefore passes, and I talked about the connection between gerrymandering and Act 10, and I think. A lot of your listeners were very familiar with Act 10. It was a legislation passed that Governor Walker proposed that took away collective bargaining rights for most public employees.
2011.
And in fact, if you're, I can explain the connection, because I came back to the Senate again in 2010, so I was there in 2011, and it's getting a map together. Getting it written, they hire people to draw the maps and so on, and then the majority party when they're going to gerrymander. And then it has to get through both houses of the legislature, it has to get signed by the governor. That usually uses up that whole next year, in this case 2011, and you don't get the maps in place for the 2012 election until usually early 2012. Well, what happened in 2011 was Governor Walker urged, and the leaders of the legislature went along with it, his own party, to get those maps drawn quickly, get them passed quickly, signed by the governor quickly. And then they showed, this got a lot of publicity in the media, they showed each Republican legislator their own new district, their own gerrymandered district, but did not show them the whole map of Wisconsin. They just showed them their own district. But what did that have to do with Act 10? Well, a lot of those Republican legislators had fairly competitive districts. They had to be, they couldn't just be a right-wing candidate trying to run in a moderate district or a left-wing candidate running in a moderate district. And so they, when they saw their maps then, they saw, wow, I can vote with my leadership. I can vote for Act 10. I can do whatever I want now, and I'm not going to get beat in November with these maps.
Because you're safe.
You're safe already.
You've got such a power base the way the maps are drawn.
So a lot of Republican legislators who had pretty good relations with public school teachers in their district or whatever, or other public employees, they weren't anxious to vote for Act 10 because they had support in their district. But then when they saw in a competitive district, but they saw the map they had, they saw, wow, I can't lose that district. I can vote for Act 10 and I won't lose in that district. So issues like gerrymandering have these policy consequences as well.
And why were they not shown the whole state map?
I don't think they wanted a whole lot of legislators, even in their own party, to to see how gerrymandered the whole state was. They only wanted to see their own district.
It's like you were kind of getting a special break.
Yeah,
district.
You've been a good trooper, so we'll show you your map.
And they were able to get that through very quickly as they wanted to, because they had the governor and they had the legislature and legislators who were not concerned about being at odds with their voters, because they knew, as you said, Tim, that they had all the voters that they needed already, the way the maps were drawn. And they got those done in time for the 2012 elections.
They got them in time. If the elections would have been in 2011, they had them done by July of 2011 and signed into law, and the law of the state, the maps of the state. There was also a very controversial mining bill back then that involved open pit iron ore mine up in southern. No, it's southern. It was in Pinoki Hills of southern Ashland County, and I was involved with that up there a lot. And that was a tough vote for Republicans too, because it's the legislation softened our environmental laws and made it easier to mine and get away with any runoff that you had from the mine. And something I didn't know until I got involved up there. I always think of a continental divide, like down the Rocky Mountains, there's a continental divide. Well, up in southern Ashland County, just south of the Pinoki Hills, there is an east-west continental divide. I never knew we had east-west continental divides. And so what that meant was all the waste from this big iron ore, open pit iron ore mine they wanted to build would flow north into Lake Superior. And that was what created all the opposition up there by the Native Americans and the white leaders of the communities. They both opposed it. And they never built the mine, by the way. But the environmental laws got weakened, but we didn't get a mine. I was happy we didn't get a mine, but all we got out of all that was poor environmental laws.
So we have these gerrymandered districts from 2011, and you have a Republican governor, you have a very strongly Republican legislature. Do you want to get into the details of how that legislature approached, if not reached, a supermajority?
Well, they wanted. See, 2010 was a good Republican year. Walker won by a comfortable margin, and the Republicans picked up a lot of seats in the Assembly and Senate with fair maps, because it was a Republican year. And if the top of the ticket is a big year for your party, if it's not gerrymandered, the down ballot races in the Assembly and Senate will reflect whatever party the voters preferred for governor or president.
Imagine that.
So they came in in 2011 with pretty good sized majorities, and then in 2012, the same top of the ticket issue was the top of the ticket. Then was a presidential race, and that was President Obama seeking his second term in 2012, and he won the second term, of course, and he carried Wisconsin comfortably in 2012. So you would think then that they would, if you had fair maps, that the Democrats would have picked up a whole lot of seats in the Assembly and Senate. Republicans never lost one single seat in 2012, even though it was a Democratic year, top the ticket, and so on, because the gerrymander was in place for 2012.
Was anybody starting to cry foul about those gerrymander districts? And what could they do about it?
Those in power didn't care what they said.
Well, of course. Well, yeah, and that's another thing we'll get into in a minute, is the whole problem of the party in power would not want to get rid of the gerrymandering, because by definition, that's what kept them or put them in power, right? So isn't that always going to be working against getting rid of gerrymandering, because the party in power is there in large measure by dint of gerrymandering in the first place?
Well, that's the Supreme Court basically ordered fair maps, and they ended up finding with these maps we have in place now that Republican legislature passed and Governor Evers signed. But you're going to have, it's why at the end of the day I devoted the last chapters to, how do we fix this permanently?
And I wanted to get into first, though, 2010, 2011. You're a Democrat. Yep. You're in the legislature, and you're trying to convince the powers that be in the Democratic Party to end gerrymandering. Why?
Well, by 2011, they were in favor of getting rid of gerrymandering because we just had...
Well, 2010 then, I guess it was.
It was 2009 and 2010. Yeah. I was a Democrat, but I wasn't in the legislature then, but I was on the Board of Common Cause. And several of us who were former Democratic legislators went to our Democratic friends in the legislature and said, you know, while you have the power, we don't know what's going to happen in 2010. You don't know what's going to happen. Adopt an Iowa-type plan or some system that takes the drawing of the maps out of the hands of the legislature and the governor. And they didn't do it. And guess what? 2010 came and the Republicans swept into power and they gerrymandered. The Republicans gerrymandered in 2011.
Would the Democrats then have, when they were in power, have had the ability to end gerrymandering in Wisconsin somehow?
Sure, they could have adopted an Iowa. The easiest thing to do would have been adopted a system very similar to Iowa, where an impartial state employee actually draws the maps. And that's called the Iowa plan.
They could have made that irreversible?
Well, yeah, well, nothing's, as long as it could probably be reversed. But I think it's important to note that Iowa adopted their plan in just following the 1980 elections in Iowa. And Republicans actually did it in Iowa. And in the same situation, the Republicans had both the governorship and both houses, and they adopted the system of an impartial state employee drawing the maps and could not consider past election results. The point I was wanting to make though was that since 1980, in the last 44 years, not a single legislator in Iowa in either party has ever introduced a bill to throw that system out and go back to the legislature drawing the map. So that's how popular it is with people in both parties in Iowa, and I think it would be enormously popular in Wisconsin as well.
Let's look at some other options, possibilities for ending gerrymandering in Wisconsin when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Tim Cullen, former Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader and Secretary of Health and Human Services under Governor Tommy Thompson, also the author of Wisconsin Gerrymandering, published in 2024 by Little Creek Press. And we need to review before we continue as to exactly what gerrymandering is. And we'll just go with Webster's definition, which is gerrymandering: the redistricting of voting districts to the advantage of one party. And that would usually mean the party in power, whether
exactly.
Democratic or
exactly.
Republican party. And we've seen that it's played out, this gerrymandering, in a variety of ways over the years in a variety of places, and in particular in Wisconsin, too. And now, having talked about some of the evils of gerrymandering, where, in effect, person's vote doesn't necessarily weigh as much as he or she would like. How would you describe, Tim, the actual disadvantage of gerrymandering?
I really think it's pretty simple. The results of the elections in the Assembly and Senate seats, the results are determined the day the maps are drawn. The results are not determined when we go to the polls in November. That I think, is the hardcore reason why this is terrible policy.
Well, that would be very demoralizing for anybody who stands in line for an hour to vote.
Yeah, I mean, they are voting for governor or president. Other votes matter too, but other elections matter. But that's what happens with a gerrymander.
And when you have a national election, presidential election, that's very, very close, as has happened several times in recent memory, that one vote for one candidate in a single district could be very powerful if it went where you wanted it to go.
Yeah, it could be. Yep.
You mentioned Iowa as a shining example of getting around gerrymandering. Did they actually pass that in Iowa with any kind of a bipartisan consensus? How did it come about?
They passed it in early 1980s. I know they had a Republican governor. I had actually met him a couple times. And I think they had a Republican legislature as well. But the I think main point I took away from that was that they did that in the early 1980s, and all the way now to 2024, no legislator of either party in either house has ever introduced a piece of legislation to throw that out and go back to the legislature drawing the maps. Because the people of Iowa and both parties, they like it this way. And I think Wisconsin would too.
So how might that happen in Wisconsin?
Well, you'd have to get the legislature to do it. And that's why I felt bad about the missed opportunity in 09 and 10 to 2010 to adopt the maps. And you'd have to have a political environment, maybe in public, you know, the public behind the idea. And then you would have to have a party and a governor, a majority in both houses and the governor be willing to do it. They could, if they really were, this is my reaction to it, is just me, but if they really thought about it, there's a 50-50 chance that adopting an Iowa-type plan would turn out to be a good deal for your party.
That's one way to look at it.
If you want to keep this system of legislature drawing maps to guarantee themselves their job, and I put all the freebies that come with having a job for 10 straight years, guaranteed. I don't know how many people listening have a job where, by their action, they can keep their job for the next 10 years, unless you're the owner of the company. I don't think so. So they get a guaranteed salary, guaranteed pension money, guaranteed health insurance, et cetera, for 10 years. That's a pretty good deal. And that applies to people in the majority party and the minority party.
Have there been any kind of surveys or votes in some form in Wisconsin asking citizens whether they would favor some kind of plan that would eliminate gerrymandering?
I've never seen that where it was a broad-based poll of citizens across the board without regard to whether they might be Republican, Democrat, Independent. I've never seen a poll like that. Maybe Marquette poll would do that. I think that would be interesting to see. I have little doubt you'd see, just like in Iowa, I think you'd see significant majority want a system that does not create gerrymandering.
I think you've indicated a time or two in your book that one way, and perhaps the most American way to eliminate gerrymandering would just be with some kind of massive vote that would, grassroots kind of push that would elect the people regardless of, that would elect candidates regardless of the gerrymandering. In other words, is it possible just to overcome it by sheer force of vote?
You could, but it's really pretty doggone hard. I mean, the gerrymandered seats in Wisconsin that existed since 2011 until February 19th of this year when Governor Evers signed these maps, those seats in the majority party are 65-70% of the voters in those districts are for the majority party. In this case, happens to be the Republicans in Wisconsin. So I don't know how you'd ever organize an effort that the person in the other party that has 30% of the voters in the district could actually overcome that. Now, maybe if the incumbent got it, it's not even reliable anymore, but if you get arrested for a few things, maybe they might throw them out, but that's not even a sure thing.
So let's look at this again. What would be a scenario for eliminating gerrymandering in Wisconsin that might actually be accomplished?
Well, I suggest three things in the book. The first one is to adopt an Iowa-type plan. And I say Iowa-type plan for one reason. In Iowa, if the legislature keeps turning down these new maps that this person draws, if they turn it down three times, his maps, then the decision goes to the Iowa Supreme Court. And I would not want that to be the final step in Wisconsin, given that we have such a partisanized Supreme Court.
And it flips
it would depend
back
on whether it was 4-3 or 4-3 or 3-4.
And it flips back and forth.
Yeah, and it just has to flip one seat. In fact, there's a big election for the Supreme Court this coming April, where Chief Justice or Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is retiring, and there's going to be an open seat, if you will, and depending on who wins, it could stay 4-3 liberal or could go back to 4-3 conservative. So it's, but also you could have federal judges draw the maps. I have to be completely honest about this. I try to be honest about everything, but I don't know how you get from here to it being a responsibility of the federal Supreme Courts, because district courts, not Supreme Courts, because those courts drew the maps after the 80 census, 1990 census, and the 2000 census. For 30 straight years, we had federal maps drawn, legislative maps drawn by the federal courts, and they never gerrymandered at all. They played it completely straight. And the reason why I prefer them is for one basic reason. They have lifetime appointments. They don't have to raise money. They don't have to run for re-election, worry about interest groups supporting them and giving them money, which is what this has become now in Wisconsin. They don't have to run again. So assuming you've put an honorable person in there in the first place, and we've had great federal judges in Wisconsin, that would be a great solution, but I don't know how to get there. It would be take some legislative support. And the third thing is a commission, which 13 states have, where it's a group of citizens appointed equal number of Democrats and Republicans. So, and then they draw the map. And they're not going to draw a gerrymandered map because they could never get a majority to agree on a gerrymandered map because it's 6-6 or 5-5 or whatever the commission would be. Those are the three ways that I would do. But the bottom line is, you have to take the drawing of the maps out of the hands of the legislature and the governor.
It seems like, a flawed idea in the first place, because the legislature is almost always going to be controlled by one party or the other, and that party would be drawing the maps to their advantage.
But you see, we had divided government from after the 60 census all the way through until after the 2010 census or election. That was when the both parties in the governorship were in the hands of one party. But for the previous 50 years, we had divided government.
You had a governor from one party and a legislature from the other.
Or you could have a governor and one party. The governor and one party, legislative body, and the governor could be one party. But as long as one of those three was in the other party, then you can't have a gerrymander.
So what are the prospects for Wisconsin, given the way things are in 2024 and the way things have been for a long time? What are the prospects in Wisconsin?
Well, it looks like some of it has to do with, of course, with that election next April. But if either these maps will stay in place until following the 2030 census. But if in that election the conservative candidate, the Republican candidate, wins that, then it flips the state Supreme Court into a 4-3 conservative group. But bringing a case to them, if the map in place now had been drawn by the state Supreme Court, which it wasn't, it would be easier to bring a case against a court for a map they drew. But this map was drawn, was passed by the legislature, Republican legislature, and signed by a Democratic governor. And the people who know more about this than me say that that's highly unlikely. They could bring the case, but it'd be highly unlikely that the court could do it. But I guess nothing's out of the question. But absent something happening like that, the current maps will be in place until 2031.
And a party that is in power, as you told us of the Democrats from a few years back, the party that's in power is not likely to espouse redoing those maps, even if they think they might be losing elections and lose power. So, I mean, is that situation likely to lead to a decision by the party in power ever to get rid of gerrymandering, do you think?
Well, we can all say a prayer tonight, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Power is a very intoxicating thing.
Does a national issue ever affect gerrymandering in Wisconsin with a kind of a top-down effect?
I, I think it's interesting to talk a little bit about the fact that after this 70 election we had, 1970, Democrat Patrick Lucy was governor, elected governor. The Democrats controlled the Assembly and the Republicans controlled the Senate. And they couldn't agree on a map in about a year, no surprise. And Governor Lucy proposed a incredible solution. He said, why don't you Republicans in the state Senate that have your majority, you draw the state Senate maps. And he said to the Democrats in the Assembly who controlled the Assembly, you draw your maps and I'll sign them. And it was like an unheard of. And so, of course, what happened, no surprise, the Republicans in the Senate gerrymandered the state Senate, and the Democrats in the Assembly gerrymandered the state Assembly. And Lucy signed them into law, Governor Lucy signed them into law. And that actually affected me because that was a state Senate seat in the 15th District, south between Madison and the state line, Rock County, Walworth County, where I had plans to run for the state Senate. And my hometown was Janesville, which was the largest city in the 15th District. But when they gerrymandered it for the 72 election, the incumbent was a Republican. He didn't want Janesville anymore. His vote was too heavily Democratic. It took almost all of Janesville out of the 15th District, my hometown. And so I ran anyway in 74. And I probably would have won except for one thing, which was when there's a big issue, I mentioned it earlier, when there's a big issue at the top of the ticket, sometimes that could have down ballot effects. And the big issue in 1974 was an issue called Watergate. So Nixon resigns because he's going to get impeached if he doesn't resign. He's told that by his Republican state senators, including Barry Goldwater. And so he resigns in July of 74. So I'm in the race now for state senate. And all of a sudden, the people got even wilder when they found out that he resigned because he was going to get impeached because he lied. And then 2 months later in September, again before the November election, President Ford pardons Nixon for all offenses he committed while he was president.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating situation, but it did not do President Ford any favors, did it?
No, it sure didn't. He claimed he wanted to get Watergate past him. But that then made the public even wilder. And so now I'm running in a district that's 58% Republican because of the gerrymander, and I managed to win. But I don't think I would have won if it hadn't been for Watergate.
Top-down issue in which, it may be a black swan kind of thing, but they do come up from time to time where the national politics trumps everything state level.
Down ballot, yep.
Well, it's a fascinating and sometimes frightening phenomenon of politics and elections and, of course, gerrymandering. And Tim Cullen, thanks for sharing your insights into it.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to have the opportunity. I also like to point out that all the profits from these books go to scholarship foundations I started in Janesville and Beloit. They're mentioned at the front of the book. So I don't make any money in this on this book or the two previous ones I wrote. So it's a little easier to push the book when you're not trying to get some money out of somebody's pocket.
And the book is called Wisconsin Gerrymandering, The Fight for Permanent Fair Maps and Why It Matters, published in 2024 by Little Creek Press, the work of my guest today, Tim Cullen. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join us the next time around for University of the Air.